Hello, this is a trimmed down podcast version of Tracks of My Life with me, Toby Davey. To catch all my guests' music tracks in full, do listen in to the hour-long version on RNIB Connect Radio every Tuesday at 7 p.m, repeated Thursdays at 1 p.m. and Sundays at 8 p.m. Hello, I'm Toby Davey and welcome to Tracks of My Life here on RNIB Connect Radio. In Tracks of My Life, we invite a guest to select a number of tracks that mean something to them and mark moments in their life. Maybe the first track they ever heard, the first track that they may have brought, and several tracks that mark moments in their life, as well as one track that they would like to pass on that might give hope for the future. My guest today is Miles Hilton Barber. Miles is a blind adventurer who has certainly travelled around the world, taking on many challenges and breaking records at the same time. Since the age of 50, Miles has set numerous world records, undertaking extreme events across all 7 continents of the world, through mountaineering, desert and polar ultramarathons, powerboat racing, scuba diving, motor racing, and long-distance aerobatic and supersonic flight, to name just a few. Through Miles' Tracks of My Life, we will go on a journey with him around the world. From his early life growing up in South Africa, hitchhiking around Australia with a friend, taking up 14 full-time roles before the age of 21, realising at the age of 21 that he was starting to lose his sight, like his brother, with not much support or help that Miles could see at the time. And we will hear, after a bit of inspiration from a trip that his brother did, that Miles decided to pick himself up and test his mind and body in many of the record-breaking adventures and challenges that he has done over the years. Hello, Miles, and
I'm Toby
welcome
Davey,
to and you're listening to Tracks of My Life here on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you, Toby.
With my
great
guest,
to be
a world-breaking
you, people.
Blind adventurer,
so much.
Miles Hilton
was
Barber.
Tricky selecting
and now back to Miles'
Tracks
of My Life, where he continues to share the tracks
so
that mark moments in his life and
back
bring back those memories.
So, yes, you brought a big struggle into my life, but I've made it.
Miles, the first track that you have chosen is I Left My Heart in San Francisco by Judy London. And I believe it takes you back to your time as a young boy growing up in Rhodesia and memories of your dad and his love of music. What was life like back then for you in Rhodesia?
Toby, Rhodesia is just above South Africa, now Zimbabwe. Lovely childhood growing up in the sunny tropics, weekends, holidays, just wandering off into the bush, dirty old pair of khaki shorts, probably no shoes, t-shirt, maybe a floppy hat if my mum saw me without one. Lovely, very safe place. We grew up on the outskirts of what is now Harare, was then Salisbury. And my dad loved his roses. And often in the morning, early in the morning, Dika, which is a very small buck, African buck, they'd come into the garden and chew my dad's roses. I mean, what a beautiful thing, a little like a Bambi. So very happy memories. My dad was the head, the director of civil aviation in the country. World War II, him and his two brothers were all World War II fighter pilots. His one brother was killed as a Spitfire pilot near the end. He and his brother both survived. And that's where I got my love of aeroplanes. And one of my earliest memories of music is my dad in the lounge. He had a hi-fi. No such thing as a stereo. I remember my dad getting his first stereo record. Ah, you guys listening probably think, what, stereo? Yes, they didn't used to be stereo. And one of his favorite songs, well, favorite singers, Judy London in the 1960s. Beautiful voice, beautiful lady. And this is why I've chosen the song.
You say your dad and his brothers were fighter pilots during the Second World War, and your love of flying came from their experiences?
Yes, Toby, and more about flying later, but one of my huge regrets is not asking more questions about my dad or my mum. I know nothing about my dad growing up in South Africa on a big farm where he grew up, and all I would say to you people listening, if you're young, your parents are alive, your grandparents, ask them questions. They like walking history books. If you're an older person yourself, think about recording your early life. You are a walking history book. As I said, one of my great regrets, Toby, is all the questions I never asked my dad and mum while they were alive.
The loveliness of Paris seems somehow sadly gay. The glory that was...
Judy London there with I Left My Heart in San Francisco. Miles, the next track takes you to a time when you were leaving home at the age of 18 and hitchhiking around Australia and New Zealand with a friend, and having 14 jobs during that time before you were 21. What made you want to leave home and travel the world?
Toby, I never went to university. I tell people the only university I went to was the University of Hard Knocks, with the colours of black and blue. I now have an honorary degree. I think for being brave and courageous, I'm not sure what for, but Derby University gave me a master's degree. My friend had an uncle in New Zealand, and we just wanted to get out and explore the world. So this track is Scott McKenzie. If you're going to San Francisco, you better wear some flowers in your hair. Amazing track from mid-1960s. I was just turning 18. It reminded me of being in my brother's university room in South Africa, Wits, Johannesburg, on the way to the ship in Durban, in my sleeping bag on the carpet, and that's just playing. So we got on a ship, my friend Ian and I went to New Zealand. My first job there was what you call a scrub cutter. We're living in a tin corrugated hut, 8x10, dirty mud floor, sheep droppings on it. And we spent 6 weeks just on our own up in a mountain, cutting down forests. Amazing. Moved to Australia as a jackaroo on a big sheep station, 103,000 acres, thousands of sheep. One of my first jobs. And by the way, as a jackaroo, you're like the lowest of the low. You go there to learn the trade. I think I was being paid less than $2 a day, $11 a week for a 6 day week. I'd be up at 6 a.m. riding bareback on a horse, just with a saddle blanket on, riding up, rounding up to 200 stock horses for the day on this big sheep station. Just an amazing experience. And then I bought a little Honda 350 motorbike, and me and a friend, we started riding around parts of New South Wales and Queensland, sleeping under bridges in parks and whatever. So great memories of Australia out in the outback, a beautiful country and beautiful people. Came back to Zimbabwe, it was still Rhodesia then, and I began working as a representative selling pharmaceuticals, drugs and cosmetics. I was a supermarket manager for one of the big supermarket chains. And I was also packaging and printing rep. Loved it, very happy time. And towards the end, learnt I was going to lose my sight. My eyes weren't good. I was having problems at night. It turned out I had retinitis pigmentosa. Went to the ophthalmologist. You're going to go blind, blah, blah, blah. No counselling, no support, nothing. Bye-bye. So I lost my confidence, my dignity, my independence. My best friend said, Miles, probably the worst thing that could happen to anybody in the whole world, and it's happened to you. And I thought, hey, isn't it great having friends at a time like that? So that was a hard time in my life, coming to terms of going blind.
And you say there was no support there for you at that time at all?
No, I'm not sure why. I'd never met any other blind people. I sort of knew they existed, but it was just strange. This is Zimbabwe, bit of a backwater in many ways. Someone said, you want to learn to read Braille? I said, oh, don't want to do that, because I was losing my sight slowly. And the last thing I wanted to do was accept it. I just denied it and just went through a hard time for a while.
How long did it take you to sort of come to terms with that loss and sort of accept it, as we've all had to do, those of us who have poor sight?
Yeah, I suppose from the age of 21, 22 until I was about 28, 29, by then I realised I had to do something, start learning how to live as a blind person. Otherwise, I was losing out in life. And I'll talk about that more with our next track.
And when you hear the track, If You're Going to San Francisco by Scott McKenzie, what sort of memories does it bring back to you?
just very happy memories of traveling around the world. I've been to San Francisco several times subsequently, but for me, it's just a memory of the 1960s, the world at our feet, young, carefree, and feeling we were invincible.
If you're going to San Francisco,
Scott McKenzie and If You're Going to San Francisco There. Mars, the next track is a theme from Chariots of Fire, that fantastic film with running at its heart, and probably an obvious choice for you as somebody who takes part in ultimate marathons. Why this particular track?
Toby, when I came to England, I now live in a little village outside Derby in the Midlands, near the Peak District. My brother, also totally blind by then, built a yacht by feel in his back garden in Durban, then sailed it solo to Australia. Totally blind, totally alone, 51 days in the Southern Ocean. Crazy. Everybody said, it's impossible for a blind man to cross an ocean solo. He said, no, not impossible, just never been done before. So that was my kick up the backside to stop feeling sorry, get on with life. And my brother said, Miles, don't focus on your circumstances, your blindness. Focus on what you want to do. And well, I thought, well, I've done no running since I was 17 or 18, better get fit. So I entered a thing called the toughest foot race in the world, along with my brother, 150 miles through the Sahara Desert, rucksack on your back. Otherwise, you've got to carry everything, they give you water. So that was amazing. That was 6 days. I'd messed up my feet beforehand. I was putting surgical spirit on, ended up putting acetone on by mistake, burnt them off. So my feet looked more like sort of raw hamburgers, but I got through. Then I did an ultra marathon across the Qatar Desert with four other guys, set a world record. It was only 120 miles, but the trick was across the desert, nonstop, unsupported. I was pulling a cart, as in a harness, weighed 400 pounds, went for 78 and a half hours without sleeping. Stupid thing to do, but I learned it's amazing if you just don't give up. Then I did an ultra marathon through the Gobi Desert in China with my son David. He was 16 then. It was amazing, amazing time running through the desert, sometimes near the Great Wall of China at dawn with these Tibetan monks singing with their bells and things just at dawn in their saffron gowns. Of course, I couldn't see that, but just beautiful in that eerie silence of the desert. And the last ultra I did was through Death Valley in California. It's called the Bad Water Ultra. The trick there is to try and run 135 miles through Death Valley, hottest place on earth, hottest time of year. The road was 200 degrees Fahrenheit, 12 degrees cooler than boiling point. The air, I think, was measured at something like 56 centigrade, place called Furnace, or the Devil's Furnace or something. Anyway, I think the big thing I've learned is if you don't give up, you know, maybe some of you people listening now are going through hard times at work, at home, family, I don't know, just keep going, you know, just one day at a time, break it down. So one of the great things about the Sahara Desert, my feet were incredibly painful. It was like running on burning coals. I've done fire walking, but this is much worse. And my feet were saying, stop, stop, we can't carry on. And I was saying to my feet, look, I'm sorry, there's nobody at home. Leave a message, I'll get back to you later. So I got through just by, I don't know, playing tricks in my head. So I just want to say to any of you listening now, whatever's going on in your life, keep going. Don't give up. You'd be amazed how far you can go if you just take that next step. And that's what Chariots of Fire is all about. Such an inspiring film.
The unforgettable theme music from Chariots of Fire by Vangelis there. Miles, the next track you have chosen could be renamed to a theme from Around the World in 80 Ways rather than Days. It's obviously the theme music from the movie Around the World in 80 Days, which inspired that intrepid python to take on the challenge, followed by a BBC film crew. What was it about that particular challenge? Why did you want to do it?
One of my friends, Robin Dunseith, he was a Scottish PR executive. He read the book and he came up with the idea of having three people with disabilities to go around the world in 80 ways instead of 80 days. So he got me. There was a chap called Mike McKenzie, one of my heroes, paralyzed from the chest down, no legs, stuck in a wheelchair. And the third person was an Irish young woman, also blind, registered blind, Caroline Casey. And at the time, she was actually riding an elephant across India, the only Western woman to train as a mahout, an Indian elephant handler. So we set her from the Reform Club in London, which is what happens in the book, Phileas Fogg, this fictitious character. Robin was there with his top hat and tails as Phileas. Great experiences. In the end, it took us 93 days, over 38,000 miles, about 110 different forms of transport. Went up to Scotland, then down through Ireland, went down the Liffey River into Dublin on a cardboard boat. Amazing. Red Sea, we were scuba diving, self-propelled scuba stuff underwater, all the way down South Africa, rode into Cape Town on Harley Davidson's. Oh, when we got to the Middle East and the Far East, India, went across parts of India by elephant, other times by camel. On elephant, we rode into Delhi on an Ellie, the three of us in a big howdah thing on the back of the elephant. Singapore, we had a great time sea kayaking. Hong Kong, we went across the harbour in dragon boats and later on in junks and things. Malaysian Grand Prix Circuit had the wonderful privilege of taking part in the first Grand Prix motor race between blind drivers. I was driving a Lotus. And we had Caroline in the Proton, the Grand Prix pace car, really highly souped up. Great fun. And there we were on the track, 57 journalists from racing magazines, newspapers, TV. As we were getting ready, we had the chap who was the head of the flag marshals, said, right, attention all drivers, yellow flag, blue flag, black flag, you know, what they all meant. And the organizer said, push off, Alphonse, we don't need you today. The drivers are all blind. Whoa. Anyway, that was great fun. And I've driven at 250 kilometers an hour. John Cook, my sighted guide, he was our manager for the project, yelling numbers and stuff. And we spun off a few times, got back on. Absolute adrenaline rush. So a lot of fun. Mediterranean, we sailed part of the Mediterranean on a three-masted sailing ship, massive sailing ship. And I'm afraid of height, Toby, but I climbed up the yardarms, ratlines to the yardarm, 90 feet up, the height of a 9-story building, and you're climbing up this tiny little thing, swaying in the wind, quite scary stuff. Tuk-tuks, Bangkok, long-tail boats racing down the river in Bangkok. In America, driving a big self-propelled howitzer, 105mm, World War II self-propelled gun. Just loads of fun. Ostriches, Alaskan huskies dragging us along. Just the most amazing thing. Police cars, fire engines. We got back, 93 days later, back to the Reform Club in London. Just a wonderful experience. Raised over $500,000 for charities along the way. And much of the time we had no idea where we'd go next and how we would get there, but we made it. So a wonderful experience, and all thanks to Robin Dunseith and his vision.
You say the three of you all had some form of disability, two of you with sight problems and one physical disability. Did you all get on during that trip, and did you all help each other out during the trip too?
Yes, I mean, one of the lovely things is that Mike, I think we're in Singapore, Mike needed another pair of long shorts or whatever. So I was pushing him and he was telling me how to get there and whatever. One of the ladies who came along as a journalist, her name was Aoife from Ireland. Oh, she had very bad marking. Do they call it a ruby marking, a port sort of marking on her face? This girl struggled so much as a child, trying to cover up this deep mark on her face. And we went to her own town in Ireland on the way through. And she stood up, you know, in front of her parents and all the people there and said, you know, I thought life wasn't worth living until I started meeting these crazy people who see disability as a bit of fun. And I think, if I remember correctly, she's now running her own charity in the UK, in Ireland, now proud of, not ashamed of her disability, but helping other people with it. So wonderful moment. And Mike McKenzie in his wheelchair in the Red Sea, we got him down to the bottom of the Red Sea in his wheelchair and decided to get a picture of me as a blind person pushing Mike along the bottom of the Red Sea using my white stick to find the way. And we did it carefully, so we weren't damaging any sand or any coral in the seabed. But that's one of the amazing pictures. I have a little business card, Toby. I think I've printed over 80,000 now because I've you know, been working, speaking at corporate events around the world. So that's one of my favorite pictures of Mike. And I said to Mike, look, when the cameraman is there, tap my leg and I want to take my mask off, take the rig out of my mouth so people can see who I am, because otherwise you're breathing, the bubbles go over your face, you can't recognize the person. So he did that, hit my leg, took the mask off, holding my breath. After about a minute, I'm thinking, that silly photographer, I'm still holding my breath, bubbles coming out my ears. Finally, Mike hit my leg, got back on the boat, and I said, that photographer is so slow. Mike said, Miles, really sorry. He took the picture quickly, but I forgot you weren't breathing. I was watching some fish. Amazing. So anyway, that was just one of the things. So on my website, there's this amazing picture of me at the bottom of the Red Sea, pushing a paralyzed man along the seabed, using my white stick to find the way.
The theme there from the movie Around the World in 80 Days. Your next tracks, Miles, featured on a CD that your wife Stephanie gave to you when you finished one of your challenges crossing Antarctica. How important to you are your wife and family, and how much have they been there for you during your life and your challenges?
So, Toby, the track that really hit me is John Denver, Annie's Song, You Fill Up My Senses. When I arrived back from Antarctica. Going back as to how it all led to this, I originally wanted to be the first blind man to summit on Mount Everest. And I'd done no mountaineering in advance of that. So I went off to Scotland, did some winter mountaineering training, grade 3 technical ice climbing, went off to the Himalayas, just training in the Khumbu region. They thought I'd died at altitude. I thought I'd stop breathing, as maybe a stroke, all the way back to Kathmandu in a helicopter for a whole lot of tests. Don't climb again, it'll kill you. I came back to the UK, was sure it was a wrong diagnosis, went and spoke to Chris Bonington, one of UK's top altitude climbers, to his doctor at Harley Street, explained, look, it was just an altitude problem, you could probably be fine. Everest might kill you, but it won't be the altitude. That messed up my option for Everest. So I went up and climbed Kilimanjaro, proved it wouldn't kill me. And then Mont Blanc, 10 days later. Mont Blanc caught in a massive storm, Toby. 4.5 feet of snow in 5 hours. 5 climbers died in the storm. So we didn't summit, but still a great experience. On Kilimanjaro, John, my sighted guide, said, Miles, if we can't do Everest next year, first blind man, top of the world. What about first blind man, bottom of the world, South Pole? So we decided that. 9 weeks later, got all the logistics sorted out, flew into Antarctica on a great Russian Ilyushin transport aircraft. You're landing on a runway, which is just ice, 5,000 feet thick. Antarctica, twice as big as Australia, beautiful place. Landed there with John and wanted to manhaul a sledge 1,200 kilometers to the South Pole. I'd never skied on snow before, and people said, also blind man, how will you be guided in Antarctica with the howling wind, this catabatic wind, if you can't see and you can't hear? I said, I don't know. And they said, Miles, you're irresponsible wanting to head to the South Pole if you don't know if it's going to work. And I said, hey, no blind man has ever been there before, so someone's got to be the first one, you know. As I often tell people, life begins at the edge of your comfort zone, so give it a go or you'll never know. So that was it. We headed off, landed there, a place called Patriot Hills, a small little twin otter flew us to the edge of the sea ice where Antarctica began. And this little twin otter left us, me, John, two others, flew away and into the silence. It was quiet that day. It's quite scary. And I'm thinking, you idiot, you know, you've now got 1,200 kilometers ago. You never skied on snow before. You're pulling a sledge several times your body weight. Whoops, big mistake. So I lifted up my sort of face masks that you wear in Antarctica because of the cold and said to John, you know, if I can pull the sledge till the end of today, pull up the tent, we can make it, because tomorrow we just do the same thing, you know, 60, 70, 80 days. So that was it, headed off. And you're climbing over 9,000 feet up the Antarctic plateau to the pole, the coldest, driest, highest continent on Earth. Great time. After 37 days, I began to get frostbite in my fingertips. I didn't know I had a problem. Turned out a circulation problem. In the end, they said, Miles, you can't continue. Got to go back to the UK for treatment, otherwise you'll lose your fingers. I wanted to carry on, but they wouldn't let me. We, via radio, we managed to get back to the base, hundreds of miles away. And by the way, if something goes wrong, the closest people to you are on the International Space Station. Oh, it's remote, baby. It's remote. So they were then in touch with a chap from the RNB who I was working for at the time, saying, look, he's got this problem with his hands, frostbite. And he was on Bond Street. It was raining. He was under a shelter, one of these canvas overhangs outside a jeweler shop, just on his mobile phone. And there's a lady with an umbrella next to him. And he closed the phone and said to this lady, I've just been talking to someone in Antarctica. And she said, oh, yeah, yeah, you know. So anyway, quite strange. So I had to fly back. I was so distraught because we were traveling faster to the South Pole than any other expedition on that route, despite having a blind man who couldn't see where he's going. So when I landed back, whew, I was, yeah, disappointed, but I'd done my best, you know, and at least I've still got my fingers, which, you know, as you know, Toby, for a blind person, your hands are very important. And I listened to this track, and it just reminds you of the incredible love and support of my wife, Stephanie. Been married 44 years this year, at least 20 times more in love with her now than when we got married. Ah, I don't deserve such a good person in my life. So supportive. She married me knowing I was going blind and never stopped me doing anything except running with the bulls in Pamplona. She wouldn't let me do that, which I thought that was rotten. The chap I was going to run with, he'd done it twice, but my wife wouldn't let me do that. And also, she wasn't keen on me rowing the Atlantic, which is fair enough because it's a long time to be away from home. But certainly, Toby, I understand that there's nothing more important in life than people and relationships. We've got three lovely children. My son, when he was 15, was climbing Kilimanjaro with me, took him out of school. The geography teacher said he's going to learn a lot more on Kilimanjaro than in class. 16, he was my guide through the Gobi Desert. He's been with me, bobsleighing down the Olympic track in Lillehammer, doing the skeleton run. And my two daughters and Dave, my son, also advanced scuba divers. So life is all about family and relationships. And this always reminds me of the most beautiful, wonderful person in the world that I don't deserve, but so grateful to have in my life.
You fill up my senses like a night in a forest, like the mountains in springtime, like a walk in the rain.
John Denver there with You Fill Up My Senses. And I think I can probably remember the James Galway version of that song, Annie's song for his wife. Miles, I think the start of your next track will evoke memories of flying for people and especially the film Top Gun. you have been up in a Hawker Hunter jet, which must have been the ultimate adrenaline rush. What was it like flying in a Hawker jet?
Toby, when I was 18, I joined or tried to join the Rhodesian Air Force. I wanted to be a fighter pilot like my dad. Kicked me out. My eyesight wasn't good enough. I failed my medical. Didn't know I was going to go blind. Then, of course, I did, as you know. Once my brother had sailed to Australia, and I realized that to be successful as a blind person, my brother said, Miles, stop focusing on your blindness. Stop focusing on your circumstances. Start with your dreams. What do you want to do? I said, well, I want to be a pilot. He said, well, find a way to be a pilot without sight. So before I was thinking, I can't fly, I'm blind, because blind people don't fly or be a pilot. Now I'm thinking, I am going to fly. How can I fly if I can't see? So I learned to fly a microlight using my ears, not my eyes. All my flight instruments, information converted into speech via a set of switches on my flying suit. So I'm a fully qualified microlight pilot. Flew a microlight from London to Sydney with a sighted co-pilot, 55 days. First time in world history to have the technology to fly and navigate. A few scary times, big storms and things, but we made it. So, and I thought, hey, if I can fly the microlight, what about the Hawker Hunter? The Hawker Hunter was the squadron of aircraft we had in Rhodesia as one of our squadrons. So I phoned a chap, Andy Cuban, was an ex-Red Arrows display pilot here in the UK. Andy, can I come and fly Hawker Hunter? Yep. Went along. I think he got a bit of a surprise because I'd gone through the checklist on the phone, you know, fully qualified pilot, yes, blah, 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 blah. So I got in the car with my white stick. Andy, where are you? Where are we hitting the airplane? I'm so excited. He said, airplane's here. It's a big airplane. What's that stick for? I said, that's because I'm blind. He said, did you tell me on the phone you were blind? And I'm sure I did. He said, I remember you saying you were a kind pilot. No, not a kind pilot, a blind pilot. So anyway, blah, blah. A lot of fun. So I took up this Hawker Hunter, Andy alongside me, strapped in like a Formula One racing driver, very tight harness, and had to learn about how to use an ejector seat in case we had a crash. Did some loops and barrel rolls. Great fun. So I was delirious, just full of adrenaline coming down. Well, the next thing, I mean, I've listened to Top Gun, Toby, about 25 times, the audio described version. I love it. So I went to a place called Thunder City, Cape Town International Airport. And they, a few years ago, they were still flying these aircraft, an English Electric Lightning. They're about 30% more powerful than the F-14s and Top Gun. So this aircraft climbs at 50,000 feet a minute. So 1960s, 1970s, frontline defense fighter here in the UK during the Cold War. Got permission to fly it. Great fun. I don't normally wear dark glasses, but I had a TV crew there, so I had to borrow some dark glasses. And I was practicing whipping my glasses off like Tom Cruise does, you know, and he's fallen with this girl. So anyway, got to the runway. It's got two massive engines, one on top of the other. And I was waiting. Just ahead was a South African Airways 737. Cleared for takeoff, off it went. We were cleared onto the runway and I took the air traffic control, X-ray Zulu, ready for departure, negative hold. So I said to the test pilot next to me, we sit shoulder to shoulder, tight little cockpit. And I said, well, Heathrow, every 90 seconds, they send him off. He said, Miles, if they let us go now, we'd go right up the backside of that 737. Oh, okay. Anyway, when we cleared for departure, full throttle, both engines, afterburner, whoop, whoop, burning 10 litres of fuel a second, 600 litres a minute, off down the runway, flame pouring out the back, doing nearly 400 miles an hour by the end of the runway, went vertical. And just over a minute later, I was at 50,000 feet doing Mach 1.4. I became the first blind pilot in world history to vomit at supersonic speed because I just had to practice all this up and going weightless. Absolute great fun. That was just one of the most amazing moments of my life. And every time I listen to this track, just gives me ants in my pants.
the unmissable sound of Danger Zone by Kenny Loggins from Top Gun. Miles, we now come to the track that you would like to pass on that might give hope to the future. What is the track? Why have you chosen it? And how do you think it will give hope for people for the future?
Toby, what I've chosen is Louis Armstrong. Wow, what a wonderful world. And I think initially, you know, going back, I thought quality of life was all to do with our circumstances. And I've learned through losing my sight, as I said earlier, I'm happier now as a blind man. So if eyesight was the secret of happiness, then everyone with 20 vision would be going wandering around, you know, grinning like a Cheshire cat. But you look at some of these people in their Rolls Royces and BMWs, they've got a face like a bag full of spanners. Sight, any of you listening to me who've got limited sight, you don't need sight to be happy, fulfilled, successful. What I learned about sight loss is it's like going through a tunnel. You can either feel sorry, sit in the tunnel, or you can go through, learn to use mobility aids, how to use computer, how to dress. You know, there's a world, it's the greatest. If you have to have sight loss, this is the best time in world history to have sight loss because of all the support. So, Toby, I've had so many wonderful life experiences in nature without sight. Life is so precious. And you know what? You don't need, we just need to stop with this pandemic, Toby. A lot of people say last year was one of the worst years for Stephanie, my wife and I. We were in one of the best years of our life. Why? Because we had time sitting out the back with our cups of coffee, watching the birds on the perches and stuff and on our bird tables. I've been doing virtual events, global events, but sitting here in my dining room, and within 10 minutes, I'm out the back with a gin and tonic in the afternoon with my wife. So all I want to say to you, stop complaining. Stop focusing on the problems in your life. Stop and count your blessings. Recognize how much you've got. If you can, get out, go for walks, sit by the river. Stop, be still, listen, appreciate, and recognize what a wonderful world we live in.
Thank you, Miles Hilton Barber, for sharing your tracks of your life with me here on RNIB Connect Radio.
Toby, it's been an honor and a privilege. And to all of you, God bless you all. Be happy. It's a beautiful world. You're part of it. Live it to the full.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.